Joining us in our second segment, as promised, is Dr. Lynn Roller. Dr. Roller is a professor of classics and art history. She's able to speak knowledgeably about historic monuments and urban centers from what was once Mesopotamia, and which is now Iraq and Turkey, southeastern Turkey. These are, of course, areas particularly threatened by war at present. Dr. Roller is an archaeologist with many years of research experience in Turkey, and she recently won the Wiseman Prize given by the Archaeologic Institute of America for the Outstanding Book of the Year in Classical Archaeology with her book, In Search of God the Mother, The Cult of Anatolian Cybele. Dr. Roller, let's start with the first ancient civilization of Mesopotamia, Sumeria. To what do we owe this ancient culture?
They were the first peoples to develop what we call complex society. They were the first peoples to develop writing. They were the first people to produce complex literary texts, complex law systems, complex works of art, complex governmental systems, complex economic distribution systems. And almost every culture that comes after them owes them their next stage in the development of human complexity. So even though the Greeks don't deliberately trace a lot of their traditions, their language and whatnot back to the people of Mesopotamia, indirectly they do. And indirectly, we are.
And thus do we. Much,
yes, that's right. We could say that. We are the heirs of these people who lived on the Tigris and Euphrates rivers so many thousands of years ago.
Just where is this area called Mesopotamia?
Well, Mesopotamia is a Greek term that refers to the area between the two rivers, what we call the Tigris and the Euphrates River. And the two rivers actually rise in what is now Turkey, and the Euphrates River flows through Syria. And then both of them meet and flow more or less in parallel courses in Iraq. So the two rivers themselves actually comprise Mesopotamia. So the area of ancient Mesopotamia includes southeastern Turkey and eastern Syria, as well as Iraq.
Dr. Roller, where would we have found these ancient Sumerians?
Well, the Sumerians are fascinating people. They were the dominant culture that lived in the southern part of what is now Iraq, the southern part of Mesopotamia, and in the area that's now in the region around the modern city of Basra and the Shatt al-Arab waterway. So it's the area which is very much in the hotbed of the active fighting, active aggressions during the war. And they are a fascinating people. They are a linguistic and racial group which has no modern descendants, but we know that they were among the first peoples to develop what we call complex societies, that is to say, complex social organizations, complex political organizations with kingships and with all kinds of class stratifications. And they were also the first people to develop a large number of complex technological advances, such as metallurgy. And
They were the first to use bronze tools,
that's right. Well, we now know that the ability to smelt bronze is a lot older than the actual Sumerian cities themselves, but the whole process of urbanization seems to have developed there. The whole process of monumental architecture seems to have developed there.
And the Sumerians are the first to develop writing.
They were the earliest people to produce large numbers of complex texts, libel texts and literary texts and various other features of complex society that we tend to think of as marking a significant advance in the development of technological and social relations in human beings.
Coming down directly today, I guess you would say, from ancient Sumeria is, people don't think about it, but the 12-hour day, 360-degree
right.
circle.
Right. They had a very interesting mathematical system, which was based on the number 6, and it's a system that I've always found a little hard to fathom why they would have developed it, but they basically had systems for marking units by 1s and by 6s, and so they kept systems of 6 and 36 and also by 60 and 360, and a lot of our own traditions that develop out of the number of 6, such as the 24-hour day, such as 60 seconds to a minute and 60 minutes to an hour come from them. The idea of recording a circle and dividing it into 360 degrees comes from their tradition.
And perhaps something that we should point out in a college community, the first people that we know of to ferment grapes into wine and barley into beer.
Certainly they were the first, among the earliest to ferment barley into beer. That's correct. I don't know how active they were in producing wine. The climate isn't particularly conducive to production of grapes, but they certainly fermented beer, fermented grain into beer, and they were certainly among the earliest people to use that as a commodity. It was one of the regular rations that was paid to people. The Sumerians were among the first people to keep, first of all, symbols and tallies, and we think a lot of it came out of their economic system, their desire to keep records, tallies of goods and services being paid. And these tallies started to, with pictographs, simple symbols that more or less look like a simple version of the idea being conveyed. The interesting thing about the Sumerians is that they made the next step into the transition of an abstract symbol system, namely of taking the symbols and using the sound, the actual phonetic sound that the word reproduced, and then just using that symbol for a sound and then combining together to produce symbols that originally meant something quite different from what the symbol came to mean, and so that one could produce a much more complex system of words and notations. By doing that, they were able to produce much more complex ideas of abstractions and philosophical ideas and adjectives and all kinds of ideas that can't be expressed by simple symbols, and they were the first culture that produced that particular breakthrough.
And a great deal of what they wrote has been preserved.
They left us a lot of very, very interesting, complex texts. They left us a very rich body of literature, which is still quite interesting to read. They left us a variety of religious texts. They left us hymns, and they left us stories, and they left us a lot of interesting school texts that were written for schoolboys to learn their letters and learn school exercises. Those are quite interesting to read. Some of the texts seem to have been very complex works of literature, and we have suggestions of the Epic of Gilgamesh. The epic itself, actually the text of the epic that we produce now, actually is owed to the recension of the Assyrians that was done in the 9th and 8th century BC, and so that the text itself actually goes back about 3,000 years, but it seems to talk about an epic and an epic tradition which goes back many, many thousands of years before that. So we think that Sumerians, like many other people, had a very active oral literature of hymns and sagas of heroes and things dealing with the gods. But they were among the first people to commit these things to writing, and the use of these texts and the shaping of these texts into literature is very much a direct inheritance from those people, yes.
It was even a couple thousand years later, they were still revering, the Assyrians were revering texts of the Sumerians,
absolutely.
might regard Roman and Greek classics today.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one reason why we know so much about them, even when the Sumerian ceased to be the dominant culture in that region and the Sumerian language was no longer spoken. I think your analogy of Latin is a good one. People continued to remember the Sumerian language, and educated people were trained to read it. And so that's one reason why the knowledge of the Sumerian language and Sumerian texts survived.
Now, I gather that in the northern part of the Tigris-Euphrates, an Akkadian people settle into these cities of Sumeria, and at that point, the civilization is best known as Sumeria Akkad, and that in particular, one leader named Sargon arose, who's quite interesting, although perhaps not that well known to most people.
He became a very almost legendary figure in his own lifetime, and the story about how he came to power is one of the earliest stories of what we call the birth of the sacred ruler story, which gets repeated over and over again and is adapted to a number of other figures. The story is originally that he was a cupbearer, that is to say, a servant in the household of a particular Sumerian king, and that he gained favor, and the goddess Ishtar, who was an important female divinity in the pantheon of both the Sumerians and the Akkadian peoples, became his lover, and she showed him special favor, and through her help gained power and went on to become a great ruler. There's a story that he was abandoned at birth, and his cradle was pushed into the waters and floated down river, and he was saved by a Sumerian princess, sort of an ancestor of the Moses and the bulrushes story.
Well, early in the second millennium BC, another group invades, the Amorites. In the north, in Akkad, they form a city called Ashur. In the south, in what had been Sumeria, they found a city called Babylon.
That's right. The Babylonians, though, seem to be the dominant ethnic group in the second millennium B.C. That's the period around 1800 to 1600 B.C. The best-known Babylonian king is probably an individual whom we name as Hammurabi. He ruled probably roughly about 1800 B.C., as dates are still slightly disputed, but we know a fair amount about him. He, too, presented himself as the favorite of the gods, and he had a particular law code which was committed to stone. Many people think he originated laws, but that's not true. The Sumerians actually had active law codes and very complex law codes. Hammurabi was one of the first ones to have a long, complex law code committed to stone, and the stone survives for us. So he's one of the earliest ones that we know about. The laws themselves are very harsh. Students often read this and they're quite taken aback by the inequitable treatment, depending on whether you're a member of the aristocracy or a commoner or a slave, and whether you're a man or a woman or freeborn or not freeborn. But it is a method of saying that this is going to be the standard procedure and we're not going to have special favors for you and different treatment for somebody else.
What's the status of some of these great archaeologic treasures from this region?
Many of them in the British Museum so that we can see them, although many others were in the museum in Baghdad. I don't know where they are now, but they were in the museum in Baghdad.
Well, let's hope well protected.
I don't know whether they're protected or not. Other people have asked me about that the Sumerians produced fantastic works of art, gold and fabulous jewelry and beautifully chased metal objects and beautifully inlaid stone palettes of all kinds. And some of these objects were removed from Iraq, but the majority of them remained in Iraq, and the Baghdad Museum used to have one of the most valuable collections of antiquities in the ancient Near East, and it's been a difficult question. Nobody knows what happens to them. One hopes they've been packed away for safety, but nobody really knows.
Well, one reason that Assyria is important to history, at least Western history, is that it starts expanding, starting in the 9th century BC, and conquers lands to the west, including Israel, and threatens Judea.
As it expands to the west, it basically conquers all of the cities in northern Mesopotamia and brings virtually all of Mesopotamia under its control. It conquers the kingdom of Judea, that's right, and brings most of the areas on the coast under control, Judea, the area of Lebanon, the Phoenician cities. It expands into southeastern Turkey. That's an area I can speak with a little bit more authority because that's where I've done some of my own field work. And it conquers a city named Carchemish, which is right on the border between modern Turkey and modern Syria. And it expands into a number of centers in southeastern Turkey. Actually, interestingly enough, the people that I've done my work with, the Phrygians, were among the few people who did not come under Assyrian control. And we know that the Phrygian king Midas originally set himself up to try and oppose the Syrian advance. And then he later breaks his alliances and makes a treaty with the Assyrians. And the Assyrians don't advance any further west. And we have a feeling that he made some alliance with them, or he basically agreed to not interfere with what they were doing if they would leave his kingdom alone. And so then the Assyrians retreat back into Mesopotamia, upper Mesopotamia.
Well, the Assyrians were certainly vicious conquerors and rather harsh overlords. They're able to actually at one point conquer Egypt, but their number comes up, apparently. They face a rebellion from the Chaldeans and themselves are conquered.
Yeah, that's right. The people of Babylonians, the king of Babylon, we think formed an alliance with one of the peoples of Iran, the peoples whom the Greeks called the Medes in western Iran, and they conquer the major Assyrian center, which was Nineveh. That's the modern Iraqi center of Kuyunjuk that I mentioned before, which is near the Iraqi city of Mosul in northern Iraq. And they conquer the city and sack it in the year 612 BCE. And that basically ends the Assyrian dominance of the heartland, which is in northern Mesopotamia and northern what is now Iraq. It didn't end the Assyrian people. One of the things we're now learning from the investigation of Assyrian sites in Turkey is that a number of these survived for a century or more after that, and Assyrian language and Assyrian customs continued to be used there.
I gather the most famous king of this Chaldean or New Babylonian Empire is Nebuchadnezzar, who's known to us from the Bible.
Well, we use the term Neo-Babylonian, New Babylonian to separate Nebuchadnezzar and his generation from the much earlier, over 1,000 year earlier period of Hammurabi. Nebuchadnezzar is kind of a funny story because he, from what we can tell, there are actually contemporary texts survive mentioning him, that he was actually a king who ruled over a very contentious time. He lived a long life and died of natural causes, from what we can tell, and it was only after his death that people started putting out stories that he was mentally deranged and that he went out and ate grass in the story.
Right.
But there's no basis for this, from what we can tell, in contemporary material. And this is just the kind of story that people like to tell about their enemy. Oh, so-and-so is so crazy. He's way off the path. He even ate grass. But there seems to be very little basis for that story.
I find it curious, Dr. Roller, that two ancient cultures have a very differing view of Nebuchadnezzar. The Greeks admired him for being a great builder, with the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, which they regarded as an ancient wonder of the world, whereas the Jewish people revile him for basically conquering Jerusalem, which the Assyrians had failed to do a century earlier, and carting the population away.
Yeah, that's right. That the northern kingdom of the Jewish community had split into two kingdoms, and the northern kingdom was destroyed by the Assyrians, and the southern one was destroyed by the Babylonians about a century later.
I gather, Professor, that in the 6th century BC, then, the cities of the new Babylonia are then eclipsed by the conquering Persians.
Well, they all become part of the Persian Empire, and all of those cities come under the control of the Persian Empire, which were based in western Iran. For the most part, I believe the Persians adopted a much more laissez-faire policy than many of the early conquerors. They allowed people more or less to stay the way they were, to continue their own language and their own traditions and their own religious beliefs, as long as they didn't make any trouble and paid their taxes to the Persians. And the Babylonians seem to have thrived under Persian rule, and the region seems to have survived and produced a large number of very interesting artifacts, interesting architectural monuments and whatnot date from this period. So we don't look on that as a period of imperial powers, as we simply look on that as a period when the Persians were one, the last one of many dominant rulers in that region.
Well, I certainly hope the archaeologic heritage of this very fascinating area can be preserved from all of what's happening now.
Well, I've heard that the U.S. military intended to try and preserve as much of the archaeological heritage as possible. They were consulting with specialists from the Archaeological Institute of America to try and map out several of the major archaeological sites and preserve them from bombing. I don't know how successful that's been. Often people go into these projects with the best of intents and then the worst of results that don't always turn out that way. It's hard for me to believe that they won't be damaged simply because lower Iraq, southern Iraq in particular, is extremely flat, and these large mounds are often the most conspicuous features of the landscape and provide good listening posts and good observation posts for miles around there, and so that they would be militarily strategic targets. So no one knows. We're just all hoping that this war will be ended soon, and then we also hope that an international community of scholars and archaeologists will be able to go back and do reparation work in Iraq.
Well, we certainly hope so. Dr. Lynn Roller, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. My pleasure.
We'd like to thank Professor Lynn Roller, Professor of Classics and Art History at UCD, for the proceeding. I would like to stress that none of what preceded or will follow Dr. Roller's presentation today necessarily in any way, shape, or form reflect her opinions. For that matter, they don't necessarily reflect the opinions of KDVS or of the University of California at Davis. But I think you knew that. I'm Douglas Everett. Let's take a break. You're listening to KDVS Davis 90.3 FM.